Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since Edward Snowden first revealed the National Security Agency's mass surveillance program to The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald, there have been growing public concerns about the invasion of privacy by the U.S. government. According to a new poll by The Washington Post and ABC News, nearly 75% of Americans say the NSA's programs infringe on privacy rights, and about half see those programs as encroaching on their own privacy. According to Glenn Greenwald, even more information will be released in the coming months. On Friday, for the first time since 9/11, President Obama held a press conference to address growing concerns. He announced that a panel of independent figures would, quote, review our entire intelligence and communications technologies. We need new thinking for a new era, end quote. He said this independent figure panel, and we'll talk about this on today's show, will report before the end of the year, but he also made it clear that the programs would remain in place. So on today's Your Call, we are putting all of this information in context. We're getting so much information so quickly, and it's important to step back and say, what does this all really mean? What is the government doing with all of this information? And joining us to talk about this is Nate Cardoza. He's a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Digital Civil Liberties Team, focusing on free speech and privacy litigation. The EFF is an international nonprofit digital rights group based in San Francisco. Hi, Nate. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Nicole Ozer is the Technology and Civil Liberties Policy Director at the ACLU of California. She works on the intersection of new technology, privacy, and free speech. Hi, Nicole. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
Great to have you. And Bruce Schneier is a renowned security technologist. He's the author of 12 books, including Liars and Outliers, Enabling the Trust Society Needs to Survive. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So why don't we start off by talking about President Obama's press conference on Friday. It's the first time that he has talked about surveillance since 9/11, saying that there will be this independent figure to review intelligence. Nate, how significant was President Obama's announcement?
Well, I think it was significant in a sense and very insignificant in another sense. So President Obama made four commitments. He said that he would work with Congress to reform Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And this is the section that allows the bulk collection of telephone records, telephone metadata. He said that he would try and increase transparency in front of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. He would try to make public as much information about these programs as possible. And then lastly, as you mentioned, he said that he would appoint an outside board to review communications technology. But he didn't say that he's going to stop the illegal and unconstitutional program. And that's problematic. As a senator, he said he would. And now he's gone back on his word.
And when he says panel of independent figures to review intelligence programs, what does that mean exactly?
We have no idea. We think it might look something like an existing board, which is called the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. But we don't really know. We don't know if the group is going to have subpoena power. We don't know if they're going to be able to get sworn testimony. We don't know if this is going to be something like the 9/11 Commission that just writes a report. So we really don't know.
And Nicole, what did you make of the announcement? The president said he would work with legislators to revamp the secretive Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA court. That's the court that grants the NSA legal authorization for its mass collection.
Well, my overall reaction to the president's press conference was just sort of how out of touch he is with the feelings of the American public about what's happening in terms of NSA spying. One quote that that was particularly shocking to me is that he described the out-of-control NSA spying as, quote, incremental encroachments on privacy. Hmm. And, you know, when you have a national security agency, which is pretty much collecting all of, you know, Internet communications that are going into and out of the United States and all call records, the ACLU and, as you noted, a great majority of the American public does not view this as an incremental encroachment on our privacy.
And Bruce, what did you make of the announcements?
You know, really the same as your other two guests. That in here, the devil is in the details. And these generalizations, we're going to have a review board, we're going to make more information available if possible. There really wasn't anything there I can point to and say this is going to be good. These all could be beneficial, these could not, it's going to depend. It's very easy to pay lip service to privacy concerns and let the NSA keep doing what they're doing. I mean, my worry is that he's trying to control damage from the documents that are being made public rather than damage the NSA is doing.
Is it significant that he's acknowledging what happened, or are you surprised that it's taken so long?
You know, I mean, he has to acknowledge it. I mean, the public opinion is turning against this so strongly. Mm. I think it took them by surprise. They didn't expect that. It stuns me that the NSA and the government didn't have any kind of contingency plan to deal with these programs becoming public, but it seems they did not. And now things are bad, and he's got to somehow convince America that they don't need privacy anymore. It's going to be a tough row to hoe, but throwing a few bones to civil libertarians might be some way he's trying to do it. I'm not impressed yet. There's been nothing that's happened. A little bit of talk about things that might happen is just politics.
What do you think about how members of Congress are responding or not responding? I mean, we're hearing, obviously, it's interesting to hear Republicans criticize this plan. I wonder if they would have done the same under the Bush administration, or did they? I should ask all of you that. But also you've got, like, Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, who's taking the lead on this. And then Dianne Feinstein from California is being criticized for not really speaking out on these programs. But what really strikes you, Bruce, about what Congress has or has not done?
Well, I think the biggest hope we have for change is that this issue is not falling along party lines. We have Congressman Stenzenbrenner, who wrote the Patriot Act, saying this is too much and too far and needs to be fixed. We have Barbara Boxer, a Democrat, who's saying that the NSA surveillance is fine. We had a House vote to kill one particular program, the collecting of phone call metadata, which almost passed. And it took a consortium of Republicans and Democrats, mostly old-school administration, to beat it back. There is broad opposition in different parties, different political affiliations, and I think that means we're going to see some change because you're not going to get the normal party gridlock. Whether this would have been approved under Bush and, the Bush-Obama, I think, is an important part of this. Mm. But now we have both presidents doing this and people in both parties criticizing it. So I think there's hope in that.
Do you agree, Nate?
I do. I agree with everything Bruce just said. We really need we need the administration to stop lying to Congress. I mean, we saw James Clapper a couple of months ago answer a question from Senator Wyden, which had been provided to Clapper the day before, so this question did not take him by surprise. And he said, no, the NSA is not collecting data on millions of Americans. That was not true at the time, and Clapper knew it. And Ron Wyden knew it, too, but he wasn't allowed to say anything. What we need is for the administration to stop blocking reform efforts. We need actual open debate, and we need the administration to stop blocking the courts from addressing these issues. So when President Obama says, I welcome this debate, we need healthy debate, put your money where your mouth is, Mr. President.
Nicole, what can Congress do in this case? What actions can politicians actually take here?
Well, Congress has an incredible amount of power. I mean, as was just mentioned, they had the power potentially to defund and stop, the mass collection of call records. So Congress has immense power here, and I guess I want to reinforce the fact that not only does Congress have immense power, but Californians have an incredibly critical role in making sure that something does happen, because Dianne Feinstein, who represents us here in California, has been a long defender of surveillance programs. She's been intractable in terms of addressing some of these civil liberties issues, and we're starting to get some traction even with her. So the importance of Californians speaking up to Dianne Feinstein and also to Nancy Pelosi, who did not vote for the amendment to rein in NSA surveillance, is incredibly critical. That will change the calculus in D.C. and will help to create some changes. So for those listeners who haven't reached out to their local representatives and to their senators to express their feelings of concern about this issue and to push for change, it's absolutely essential that they do so.
Because California politicians have a lot of power here on this issue.
California politicians have a lot of power here, and Dianne Feinstein has a particular amount of power here in terms of her position in the Senate.
And Nate, can you just give us an overview? What is her position exactly?
She's chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. She is Dianne Feinstein is responsible for the oversight of Congress over these programs. And then we hear things like Dianne Feinstein saying, I'm not a high-tech techie, but I've been told that abuse of these programs is not possible. I mean, really? That's congressional oversight that we're getting. So, yes, please apply pressure to your senators and congressmen to actually provide the oversight that they're supposed to be providing.
And can you talk a little bit more, just elaborate on that a bit? I mean, has your office been in touch with any of these politicians?
Absolutely.
And what response are you getting?
Well, from Dianne Feinstein, we've gotten, look, these programs provide an invaluable national security tool. Trust us, everything's fine. That's what we get from Feinstein. From people like Ron Wyden in Oregon, we get a much better response.
But I would have to say, you know, the ACLU, we have a Washington legislative office. We have, you know, many, many people working around the clock on this issue. Early on, we heard from the legislators that they were not hearing from their constituents and that this must not be of great concern to them. Mm. And as people have ramped up, as so many people have started calling, we've seen changes. We've even seen Dianne Feinstein say, well, maybe there do need to be some changes. So it's working, and we need to keep applying the pressure.
And that is Nicole Ozer. She's Technology and Civil Liberties Policy Director at the ACLU of California. Nate Cardoza is a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Digital Civil Liberties team. And Bruce Schneier is a security technologist, fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, author of 12 books, including Liars and Outliers, Enabling the Trust Society Needs to Survive. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about all of the revelations, not just about the NSA, because Reuters broke a very important story about the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, seeking access to hidden intelligence evidence, and we'll talk about that today. And so we're basically putting a lot of this in context. So much information is leaking at such a fast rate, and The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald says so much more is going to come out. In fact, today there's a new piece called NSA Loophole Allows Warrantless Search for U.S. Citizens' Emails and Phone Calls. So people at the ACLU, I know, are overwhelmed by this. We're all kind of overwhelmed by it. If you have questions about what this means, we'd love to hear from you. And do you think that all of these revelations will result in any significant changes? What changes would you like to see? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We just heard from Nate and Nicole saying that California politicians are not hearing from their constituents. Have you called? Do you plan to call? And if so, what are you planning to say? We'd love to hear from you. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Bruce, you have been working on these issues for a long time now. What about these revelations surprised you? What is the takeaway from all of this?
You know, it's interesting because it's in some ways surprising and not surprising. I mean, a lot of us who studied the NSA and surveillance knew that the NSA was collecting everything they could outside the United States. You know, before this program, there were revelations about a program called Echelon a decade ago, and that anything going across the U.S. border counts as outside the United States, and that's being collected. So in some ways, that isn't surprising. What is surprising to me is the brazen way they're manipulating the law to do it. You know, so we're reading about how they would build these programs and then look for some sort of legal justification they could twist and turn and satisfy themselves. And if one legal justification didn't work out, they would go find another. That there is this need, visceral need, to collect everything, not only about foreigners, but about Americans too. And the notion of the NSA collecting everything we do on the internet is sort of very surprising, even though if we thought about it, we probably knew, but we just didn't imagine they would do it this much, this brazenly, this completely, this quickly.
And the other question, I mean, we did a show about this a couple weeks ago about oversight, and then just really who has access to all of this information?
Well, I mean, that is the fundamental question. And remember that no one who's saying these programs need to be stopped are saying that the government never should invade our privacy. I mean, we already give the government an enormous power to invade our privacy, to solve crimes. We do that willingly. We do that knowingly. But the reason we make that work is through transparency and oversight. You know, if we give these powers, we need to be ensured that they're being used properly. So transparency, we know what's going on, and oversight, that those who are doing it are monitored so they don't abuse them. That's what's lacking here. These programs, I've heard the NSA described as an organization that's gone rogue, a criminal organization. That has to do with the fact that nobody is monitoring them. There's no controls. The FISA courts aren't working. Congressional oversight isn't working. We are all completely in the dark. So we have no way of knowing if these programs are any good, if they're effective, are they worth it, what are the costs. We know nothing.
Well, we have a call from a military veteran who did security encryption with the NSA. Let's hear from John in Berkeley. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I did not exactly work with the NSA, but I worked with NSA-related equipment when I was in the military, and I got to know a lot about the capabilities of it. And I can just give a little history lesson here. The National Security Agency was created in 1952 under a classified executive order by President Truman. Its existence was not revealed until 10 years later when President Kennedy publicly revealed it. What we are dealing with here, ladies and gentlemen, is a legacy of the Cold War. The National Security Agency has been spying and listening in on communications here in the United States for over 60 years. The only difference is that the level of technology has increased. And what you have here, in effect, is a national security state whose charter is the National Security Act. And who, no matter who sits in the White House, this national security state will perpetuate itself. And what we are dealing with here is an institution that has gone out of control. And in my opinion, the only way that we could stop this is repeal the National Security Act, or in other words, or otherwise, amend it radically. But to me, this is the only way you can stop it, because to paraphrase Lincoln, a national security state and a democracy cannot coexist.
Well, John, since you have so much, thank you for calling, but since you have so much experience with this, what do you think citizens can do about this?
Vote out those in office who support it, for one.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, John. And Nate, what are your thoughts about John's comment? The only way to really deal with this is to amend the NSA radically.
Well, I think that EFF would probably argue for more incremental reform than that. One of the things that we need to do is to get the meat of these programs in front of a court and actually just have an open court rule on the constitutionality of the Section 215 program, the Section 702 program, and the rest of the revelations that we get from the Snowden documents. And we need the Obama administration to stop blocking that. I mean, we hear from them repeatedly that these programs are authorized by the law and constitutional, and yet they've refused to release the legal justifications that supposedly authorize them, and we've seen them refuse time and again to allow courts to rule on the constitutionality. So I think enforcing the laws that we have now, namely the Fourth Amendment and a reasonable interpretation of Section 215 of the Patriot Act and Section 702 of the FISA, would be a good start.
So how would you go about doing that? How would you bring these programs into a courtroom?
Well, so EFF sued to stop what we now know from Snowden was happening. We sued back in 2006, and we, after Congress passed a retroactive immunity statute making AT&T immune from their participation in the program, we sued the NSA itself in 2008. And that case is called Jewell versus NSA, and it's currently before a federal judge here in San Francisco. The the Obama administration has continued the Bush administration's position that the program is a state secret and they can neither confirm nor deny its existence. That position is frankly ludicrous at this point. I mean, we're here talking about it. It's on the front page of The Guardian, The New York Times, Washington Post. It's not exactly a state secret. So it's time for them to drop this state secrets privilege claim over what we all know to be the program and finally let a federal judge rule on it.
And Nate, I know we have to let you go in a couple of minutes. And before we go back to calls, I wanted to ask you the same question. What really surprises you about these revelations and what's the takeaway for you?
Part of what's surprising is that people are surprised. I mean, this is, I hate to say we told you so, but we told you so. We at EFF and our friends at ACLU have been challenging these programs for years. And the administration has finally been forced to admit it because here Edward Snowden leaks an actual order signed by an actual FISA court judge with the words top secret over the top. It's like that's what it takes to get them to admit this program exists. So that's surprising to us. And then finally, like the actual scope of this, the fact that they actually asked a court to permit them to view the metadata records of every single call that every single American makes, and they've been doing so every 90 days for the last 6 years, that's surprising. And frankly surprising that we haven't had a leak like this earlier.
Now, what happens behind the scenes at the EFF? I mean, when you have so much information now that's out in the public, what do you all plan to do about it? I mean, are you just going to continually bring about lawsuits?
Yeah, well, we filed a new suit against the Section 215 program a couple of weeks ago on behalf of a very broad coalition of civil liberties, religious, and policy organizations. In that case, is First Unitarian Church of Los Angeles versus the NSA. And the plaintiffs in that case are Unitarians, the Council on Arab-American Relations, or American-Islamic Relations, Greenpeace, Tech Freedom, all sorts of organizations from across the political spectrum. We're going to continue suing. We're going to continue to talking to people like you about it and lobbying in front of Congress to get Congress to exercise their oversight responsibilities.
And Bruce, what are your thoughts on these strategies?
Well, I think that, I mean, I'm not a legal person, but I think the more fronts we can open, the better we can do. EFF has lawsuits, EPIC has lawsuits, ACLU does. There's a lot of different dimensions we're going at this through Congress. In a sense, this is a political problem. The solutions are going to be political. They're not going to be technical. So whether it's Congress or the courts or some combination, I mean, this is going to be the only way we can get these programs rolled back and sort of figure out among ourselves as a society, what does privacy look like in the information age? I mean, does the fact that you're using a cell phone or using Facebook mean that you have no privacy? It can't. Right? Society can't work that way.
Yeah.
So what does it look like? We have to figure it out, and these are the ways we figure it out.
And let's address that question right after the break. On today's Your Call, we are talking about all of the recent revelations from the NSA, but as the ACLU's Nicole Ozer says, it's about so much more than the NSA. Reuters just had an explosive piece last week about the Drug Enforcement Agency, about criminal defense lawyers and the information that they have access to. So we'll talk about that also after a break. And we'd love to hear from you. How do you make sense of all of these revelations? What questions do you have? And Nate Cordoza, staff attorney with the EFF, has to leave us. So thank you so much for joining us, Nate.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And we'll be back right after this break.
Your Call is always a better program when more folks get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, the number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send us a question or comment via email. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about the state of economic justice 50 years after the March on Washington, August 28, 1963. The march included calls for the elimination of racial segregation and major public works programs to create jobs. So what did jobs and freedom mean back then? And what does it mean today? And then on Wednesday, we'll have a conversation about what makes a good charity. There's a new report out from the Center for Investigative Reporting called America's Worst Charities. So we'll find out about their list and then talk about what makes a good charity. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about all of the NSA revelations. We wanted to put this in context and talk to people who closely follow these issues to find out what is surprising and what is the major takeaway from these revelations. Edward Snowden gave Glenn Greenwald between 15 and 20,000 documents, and Greenwald says they are meticulously reading these documents and they will continue to have reports in the months to come. So we're getting, gosh, I'd say a story a week, and it looks like we're going to continue getting this information. So we're putting it in context. What does this mean? What questions do you have? And then Bruce Snyder, one of today's guests, asked a question that we often ask on this show. What does privacy mean to you? And how do these revelations really change your perspective and your views on privacy? We've got full lines, but we'll have one open in a few minutes. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Bruce Snyder is a renowned security technologist, a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, author of 12 books, including Liars and Outliers, Enabling the Trust Society Needs to Survive. Nicole Ozer is the Technology and Civil Liberties Policy Director at the ACLU of California, and she works on the intersection of new technology and privacy. And let's hear next from Cynthia in San Francisco. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I want to contact my local politicians and let them know I'm going to be supporting politicians who are demanding answers on this. Can anybody let me know of local politicians who are speaking out about their concerns about the surveillance state?
Oh, you mean at the local level?
At the local level, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Nicole, do you know of local politicians?
I don't know that anyone, you know, back in post 9/11, there were a lot of local communities that did resolutions against the issue. I don't know of any that are currently moving, but certainly, you know, if you're local, you know, the Board of Supervisors could do this, local members of Congress, local assembly members. There is a resolution that's been moving through the California legislature about this issue as well. So contacting your local assembly member or California member of the Senate would also be a good move in this area. If folks don't know who that is, you can just go online and search for sort of the areas and how to contact each of those people.
Well, can you talk a little bit about how, for example, state officials, what role they could play here?
Well, there are a couple things that state officials can do. Obviously, there are some resolutions that are being proposed sort of addressing these issues, but members of the state legislature can also do important things under state law to really address some of the issues that we've been talking about big picture here. You know, one of the earlier callers talked about how technology has really advanced and that we see, you know, this is an issue that's much bigger than the NSA. We see the NSA really taking advantage of all the technology that's at their disposal now and being able to also take advantage of some really outdated laws and oversight to gain access to so much information in ways that are really infringing on privacy. But we also see that this is really a systemic problem, that as we've moved to email and cell phones and searching online, we see sort of all levels of government, from the local police on the street all the way up to the NSA, really trying to take advantage of outdated laws to really reach into the treasure trove of information that companies like Google and Facebook and our cell companies have about who we are and where we go and what we do. And we really need to upgrade privacy laws to keep pace with what's currently happening. And here in the state of California, the ACLU and other organizations are working on a state law to make sure that state law enforcement can't access our email without a warrant, going to a judge and showing probable cause. And that law is moving through the state legislature right now, and people, we really need people's help to make sure that it passes and gets signed by the governor. So that's something we can do locally to really push back and say, look, you know, we don't want the government, whether it's at the local level or all the way to the top, getting access to our personal information without good reason and without proper oversight. And if people are interested in that, they can go to our website at aclunc.org, and there's more information about that bill.
Okay. Well, and also, because, Bruce, it's important to point out that we're seeing some programs also at the state levels, and I'm wondering what really strikes you about that. Ollie Winston with the Center for Investigative Reporting recently reported that local officials in Oakland are pushing forward with a federally funded project to link surveillance cameras, license plate readers, gunshot detectors, Twitter feeds, alarm notifications, and other data into a unified, quote, situational awareness tool. It's called the Domain Awareness Center. It's a joint project between the Port of Oakland and the city, started as a nationwide initiative to secure ports. So what are your thoughts on these kinds of programs?
You know, and you can see a lot more, because next thing you do is you link facial recognition with the public database of photos on Facebook, which has been done, to automatically identify people. You add footage coming from drones. You add all of the databases. It's never one thing. It's everything together. It's this combined with that combined with that. And, you know, it's sort of what's going on. The way to think about it really is there's a public-private surveillance partnership. The business model of the Internet is surveillance. Google makes money through surveillance, right? They watch what you're doing and serve you ads that they think you will be interested in. Facebook does the same thing. All these companies are making money on your data. And it's just now convenient that the government wants this data too. And at all levels, they're trying to get at it with less and less oversight. Right? So instead of a warrant, it could be a subpoena. Instead of a subpoena, it's a national security letter. Instead of a national security letter, it's asking a company nicely just to give them a copy of everything. And our laws are so lax about our data that in a lot of cases, they can get away with it. Right. Companies like Facebook collect everything and can sell it and give it away however they see fit. There are no rules protecting our data once they have it, because we've given it to them. But that's the way the Internet works. Right? All computers produce data about us, and we're talking about what happens to it afterwards. So there's a really very broad discussion we need to have about our data. What does it mean when we use a credit card? Are we saying to the credit card company, well, you now know what we purchased, you can sell that information, you can give it to the government, you can do whatever you like? Or are we saying, you know, we are trusting you as a financial intermediary to keep our privacy? And that's where we need the discussion at a very high level.
Right. Well, and so, I mean, just to add to this list, you've got the ACLU recently released documents filed by, they got this information from FOIA requests confirming that police license plate readers are capturing vast amounts of data on innocent people. And then we recently learned that the Mail Isolation Control and Tracking Program involves the Postal Service computers photographing the exterior of every piece of paper mail that's processed, about 160 billion pieces a year. So that's why I'm just trying to make sense of all of this. You've got all this NSA, these NSA revelations, the license plate, the post office, the DEA recent revelation from Reuters. I mean, how do you make sense of this, Bruce? How does the average citizen make sense of this?
You almost can't. And I think one of the problems is the huge cognitive dissonance. It's hard to imagine the government collecting every phone call, every email, every tweet, every Facebook message. I mean, the volume of data sounds unimaginable. We think that we can hide just by being one of 100 million, right? And who could ever sort through all of that data? Well, it turns out computers are really, really good at sorting through all of that data. And over the years, over the decades, they've gotten faster and faster, and they are able to. So this data, it can be used and can be collected. To me, speaking about the individual programs is almost beside the point. You know, so you mentioned license plate scanners, and a lot of local governments have those. They have them on street corners, they have them in parking lots, they have them in roving vans, and you, through a license plate scanner, can collect basically surveillance data on everybody in town. Well, that sounds bad, but your cell phone company does it too. You're carrying a tracking device in your pocket. It's your cell phone. Your cell phone company knows exactly where you are 24/7. So here's the same data being collected somewhere else. Or surveillance drones can now collect a lot of that data also. So there are so many paths to our data. Looking at any one program almost obscures the big picture.
So what about the big picture, Nicole? I mean, how do you deal with the questions that Bruce brings up about what privacy really means in this age of technology?
Look, we're all living digital lives now, particularly here in the Bay Area. We are often early adopters of this technology, and everything we do these days, you know, leaves behind these digital footprints of who we are and where we go and what activities we do and who we know and what we're concerned about. And the reality is that, you know, technology is going to continue to advance exponentially. And we need to find, you know, the way to make sure that our privacy laws don't remain in the digital dark ages. So, you know, the privacy policy, we often, you know, we see privacy policies for companies. The privacy policy for the government to make sure that they don't access our information without oversight is called the law. And we need to update these laws to keep pace with our current technology. Most of the privacy laws that we're talking about right now haven't been updated since the 1980s, before the web existed, when cell phones were the size of bricks, when people couldn't imagine that we'd be keeping emails for longer than 6 months. So we've got incredibly outdated laws, and we've got oversight and transparency that a lot of it that was gutted post 9/11 in the Patriot Act. So we have this confluence of factors where technology has advanced, the law hasn't kept pace, and oversight and transparency has in some ways been reduced as this technology has advanced. And those are the big picture issues that we work here at the ACLU and at other organizations. We absolutely need to get a hold of this issue and make sure that there are some important safeguards and transparency and oversight that gets put back into place, both with the NSA, but as you mentioned, you know, things that are locally happening like the DAC Center in Oakland. We have to put back in those safeguards and that transparency, and it's very doable. There are laws that are moving through Congress right now, and as I said, on the state level as well. So, you know, what can seem sort of like an overwhelming issue as we sort of go through all these issues, what it comes down to is that there are places where we know that we need to make changes in order, as, you know, as the president talked about, rejiggering the balance. There's a lot of rejiggering that needs to take place because, honestly, several administrations haven't dealt with it in, you know, 20 years, and we have some catching up we absolutely need to do.
That is Nicole Ozer, Technology and Civil Liberties Policy Director at the ACLU of California. Bruce Schneier is a security technologist and fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. Let's hear from Declan in San Francisco. Hi, Declan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about, in response to these groups like Silent Circle and Lava, which have kind of been forced to close as a result of offering really protection and privacy in the Internet space. And just curious what your panel would say, you know, what's the role of private enterprise here? Mm-hmm. You know, is there a way that the ACLU or an organization might even, I don't know, be able to kind of put a list together of you know, organizations that are complicit and those that aren't, and anything like a seal that, you know, we could make intelligent decisions as consumers even.
Well, thank you. What about that, Nicole? Because these companies are in our backyard here.
Well, I think, you know, we've done a little bit in terms of putting together a list of sort of which companies are working on transparency and not. One of the problems that we see, you know, as we saw with LavaBit, some of these companies are being asked to do things and they can't talk about it. So, you know, it's not always clear who's complicit and who's not complicit in some of these issues. We've got, you know, gag orders that are happening. And so there's a lot that we still don't know about what's happening behind the scenes.
And Bruce, in your latest piece for The Guardian, you write that what we're seeing here is a corporate government surveillance partnership, one that allows both the government and corporations to get away with things they couldn't otherwise. Can you talk about that?
I mean, it's what I talked about before, that there's this confluence of interests. And now the government is effectively commandeering the Internet. I think that's a good term to use. And just like in wartime, they would commandeer an assembly line to build tanks. They're commandeering the Internet for surveillance. Right? They're getting around prohibitions that they have against collecting and getting industry to collect for them and just getting a copy. And we see things going the other way. We're seeing companies use secrecy rules under national security to protect instances of malfeasance on their part. And so we're seeing both of these groups using the other's law to circumvent their own rules. I mean, and the Lavabit case is real interesting. The story is last Friday, I think it's Thursday, a small email company, which popped up after 9/11 to offer more secure email, abruptly shut its doors, posting a message on its homepage saying basically, I can't tell you why. Things are bad out there. I can't offer the security I wanted to, so I'm shutting down. And you know, you read between the lines, he's got national security letters. This was the email service. Edward Snowden used it. Probably others use it too. And he's trying to fight them. It seems not to be going well, and he decided to shut the service down. It'd be interesting. That's something he could do because it's his company.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Imagine Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook doing the same thing. He couldn't. He'd be fired.
Hmm.
Right? Because that's a big public corporation, it has to cooperate with the government. It has to hand over all of our data in ways that a small proprietorship doesn't. So I think it's a really interesting lesson. Right? There is value in being small because you're more agile, but in both cases, you could be compelled to do something you don't want to do. I mean, unfortunately, you have to believe that everybody is lying to us about this. The government's lying. The companies are lying. We don't know who to trust because we cannot verify the truth of any statement. When Apple says, I've never heard of the PRISM program, which they said, I look at that and say, of course you didn't. PRISM is the internal NSA name of the database. It's not the name of the program. You know it by something else. And it's a very carefully worded denial designed to make you believe something that is entirely not true. And these are happening again and again, both by government officials and by corporate officials.
The other big question here is, what are they doing with this information? Of course, the administration says this is all about terrorism. But what else? I mean, protests? Bruce, do we have any idea what else they are doing with all of this information?
Well, this is where it gets really scary, because once you build a surveillance infrastructure, it begs to be used. So, right, we're told this is only used against terrorism. But we learned last week that the Drug Enforcement Agency uses this data and then lies about it in court. We know that there have been requests to use this data in other crimes, in things like copy protection. Can you imagine there's a kidnapping case which makes the headlines? Is the NSA going to deny the data? Could they? We are having defense attorneys now try to get access to the data that they believe will show that their clients are innocent of crimes. And now that's being denied. Once this data is in place, once you build the technology of the national security state, why not use it for everything? Why not use it for copy protection? Why not use it for speeding? And then you really are getting into a police state. And I think that's a very real fear. I mean, it sounds far-fetched, but we've spent the money to build it. Why not use it? That's going to be the mentality.
Can you quickly tell us about the DEA program? This story was broken by Reuters.
I don't know much more than I read in the Reuters story, but the DEA was using this data to look for drug smugglers, and because it's inadmissible in court, once they caught somebody, they would invent new evidence that they could present in court to cover up the fact that they were using illegal surveillance data to find the person. I mean, this is way illegal. This isn't even a little bit illegal.
Mm. Yeah, and criminal defense lawyers are now challenging this. And Reuters has a new piece up, how DEA programs differ from the recent NSA revelations. We've got about 7 more minutes with Bruce Schneier and Nicole Ozer talking today about all of these revelations. What does this mean exactly? We're putting this into context. And you can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org, and we'll try to get as many people on before we end. Let's hear from Larry in El Cerrito. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I have a question and give you the reason for my question. Question is, what's being done in the policy arena to craft change, to craft new policies that are changing the situation? The reason I ask this is clearly hearing this discussion, this is really a policy issue. And a lot's been done. If you think of Kingdon's three streams of policy change, we've reached a real important point where something that had been a condition for 50, 60 years is now being seen as a problem. It's changing. And there's a public recognition and a raising of public expectations of change. So the next stream that's really important to have ready is when policymakers are ready to make a change, what change is minimally protective of the public, and is it ready to go?
All right. Well, thank you. We'll get a comment in a minute. I just wanted to read an email from Bill who says, Feinstein is not accepting other views. I wrote to my senator to register my objection. I addressed her as a constituent. I received a general response telling me that her view was that the program was necessary and should proceed. I would have accepted information regarding the number of voters who favored the programs contrasted with the numbers of citizens with my sentiment. I believe she does not feel any obligation to the voters who do not agree with her. So there's someone who contacted Senator Feinstein, Nicole, and that's the response he got. What are your thoughts on Larry's call? Like, what are some policies that Congress could put on the table today?
Well, you know, the ACLU is working on many, many fronts on this. You know, we have a lawsuit, ACLU versus Clapper, about these issues, but we are working around the clock in D.C. on these issues, both our lobbyists and legislative counsel, and we've, you know, already testified in 2 hearings before Congress on this issue, and we have a whole list of issues that we think really need to be addressed. We have a lot of these policies sort of ready to roll in terms of changing issues. I mean, one, of course, is as a big picture on this NSA issue, we have, the NSA going to a secret court where only the government is heard, interpreting a secret law to get access to all of Americans' call records and all of Internet traffic into and outside the United States. There's no transparency about how often this happens or what's really happening in the FISA court. So definitely some changes both in the FISA court as well as Section 215, which is authorizing this mass surveillance. Section 215 of the Patriot Act is incredibly expansive, and for years we've been trying to rein it in, and so there are specific changes to 215 that need to be put in place as well.
And we've got I want to get to a few more questions just quickly. Nicole, where does Nancy Pelosi, Congresswoman Pelosi, stand on these issues? We just got an email from Faye.
Well, she didn't vote for the Amesh Amendment, which would have reined in Section 215 on the call records program. So, you know, she didn't vote for that, and she should have. And so she definitely needs to hear from more constituents on that issue. But, you know, in the past she has been, pretty sympathetic to civil liberties issues. And so she's definitely movable on these things. And in terms of Feinstein, you know, the fact that people are getting a form letter back, I would just have to say that the calls and the emails do make a difference regardless of what you hear back from the member of Congress. When people started making calls to members of Congress, we heard from them. All of a sudden, I'm getting members and constituents that are telling me this is really important, and it started to change the calculus in D.C. So I would tell people that it just really is critical and makes a huge difference, and we are making progress on this issue, and we just need people to really keep up the pressure, particularly here in California, where our members of Congress are such essential pieces of this potential for change.
And we don't have time to take Ruth Ann's call, but she wanted to know, will there be repercussions for journalists breaking these NSA stories? There's already a major crackdown on whistleblowers, but Bruce, what about the journalists?
Well, we don't know. I mean, there is a war on whistleblowers going on right now in the Obama administration, and there is a lot of pressure against journalists. I think we are all very lucky that Glenn Greenwald is not going to be cowed by this, and he will continue to be an investigative journalist and release these stories. But we don't know, and I think that is another piece that we have to start thinking about. I mean, we don't know how many documents are out there, how many are going to be released, what they are, what the next year is going to bring. It's sort of interesting times to live in.
Yeah, and he says so much more is to come. Bruce, final thoughts, 30 seconds. I mean, other than calling your congressperson, what else can citizens do? And again, I mean, how can we kind of digest all of this information?
I mean, digested by keeping reading. And I know it's hard, and it often sometimes seems like too much, but we have to stay informed on the issues. This is a political problem. This is not a technical problem. There will be political solutions. Mm-hmm. So pressure on your legislatures, voting, protesting, anything you can do to make your voices heard. I mean, this is the paradox of democracy, right? We have no power, yet we have all the power.
Mm-hmm. And Nicole, a brief final thoughts?
Well, there are two parties that are cooperating in this surveillance. There's the government and there's the companies who have this data. And so, you know, we as users of these companies, these large companies, need to also push back on them. They need to be doing more to help change this law and be transparent about how many demands they're getting. So, you know, both our legislators and the companies that we're doing business with need to hear from us loud and clear that we need stronger oversight and better controls and that we do want our privacy in the 21st century.
Nicole Ozer is with the ACLU. Bruce Schneier is a security technologist. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the San Francisco 99% Coalition is having a NSA Surveillance and Us Forum, What We Know and What We Can Do About It, Sunday, August 18th, 3:45 to 6 at 1187 Franklin, the Unitarian Center. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thanks for joining us. 50 years after the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, what is the state of economic justice? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the August 28, 1963 march, which included calls for the elimination of racial segregation and major public works programs to create jobs. So what did jobs and freedom mean back then, and what do they mean today? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.